This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
I always enjoy coming back to the Hartford Street Zen Center.
This setup is a little funny, so excuse us for multiple schedulings that we've done.
Yeah. Oh, we can have a casual time together. I'm very touched to hear that Maitri is coming back and for a reunion here. And what is the nature of the?
I have to confess, I don't actually know. I don't think it's a training.
It is a training.
So I was very fond of Isan Dorsey, and I'll mention him today in my talk. So there were two monks walking through the mountains, and they had each taken a vow of celibacy. And they were traveling from one temple to another. And they came to a rushing stream, and there was a beautiful young woman standing there on the shore. And the two monks approached, and it was clear she was very frightened to cross the river on her own. And so one of the monks picked her up and very carefully carried her across the rushing stream and very gently set her down on the other side of the river. And the monks continued, and after they'd been walking quite a while, one of the monks said to the other one, "I can't believe you picked up that woman. Did you forget your vow?" And the other monk said, "Well, I set her down on the edge of the river, but you've been carrying her all this time." And this is one of those Zen stories that I heard very early in my practice. And I think, you know, these simple Zen stories are often a little puzzling. And then sometimes in our lives, they pop back up to teach us. You know, this is one of those stories that I heard that made me laugh, of course. And what I think of now when I hear that story is that for us not to be too attached to the teachings, to the extent that we forget common sense. So, of course, it was common sense to help this woman cross the river. But I'd like to talk today about the importance of humor in our practice. And when I think of the Dalai Lama, or if you've read Crooked Cucumber, the biography of Suzuki Roshi, or certainly Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, these wonderful Buddhist masters, you know, while they practice diligently and teach us about practice, they've endured terrible hardships and yet can be very lighthearted. You know, whenever I see the Dalai Lama, he's laughing his head off. he just seems to have so much fun. And Thich Nhat Hanh tells us to smile gently when we sit. And Suzuki Roshi, I didn't even realize how much hardship and suffering he and his family went through. And yet, if you get a chance, you can see these films of Suzuki Roshi at Tassajara playing with children and playing with a yo-yo. And, you know, he could be a very fierce teacher too, but very lighthearted and kind of childlike. So, you know, how can this be when the Buddha taught that life is suffering? And when I came to Zen Center, I was a very broken person. This was in 1975. I was really confused and battered, and I was looking for another way of life. So when I heard that life is suffering, I thought, yeah, right, you know, it really is suffering.
Laura, excuse me for interrupting. Is the incense bugging you, coming around your head in clouds like that?
Not at all. Okay. Not at all. Thank you. Of course, I learned later, I focused more on the fourth noble truth, that there is an end to at least some of our suffering. But, you know, I love to think about Isan because he was such a childlike person with a wonderful innocence and sweetness about him. And He made us all laugh a lot, and he had a lot of fun with his practice. And he and I would sometimes host these skit nights at Zen Center. And I remember one of them in particular, you know, he came out and sang this song, "A Hard Man Is Good to Find." Very hard act to follow, because I was right after him. And then later he came out dressed in this big diaper with a rattle and a little cap on his head, and we sang, "Fairy tales can come true. It can happen to you if you're young at heart." So he was very precious to me, and he loved children too, and he loved my daughter Nova. And it was just a delight to be around him, which isn't to say he didn't have pain and suffering and regret in his own life, you know. It says on the Han at Tassajara, life and death is a serious matter, don't goof off. And that's important, you know, we're told to practice as if to save our head from fire. And of course, wholehearted effort and diligent practice are essential. But I came across Zen Master Tendo Nyojo's death poem. There's a tradition among Zen masters to dash off a poem right before the end. And he said, I've given you my all, tossing it your way with a hearty laugh. I entrust it all to the spring wind, for there is nothing more I need to do. So I really love this poem. It's a sort of like, that's it, you know, I've given you my all with a hearty laugh. And a kind of lightness and detachment in that that I find very attractive. I was very surprised when I would go to memorial services at Zen Center, because the funerals that I had been to were very serious. But at a Buddhist memorial, at least in the Zen Center tradition, there's quite a lot of laughter and a lot of affectionate, you might say, teasing about the person who died. And I'm sure most of us have been touched by death in some way, and you may have noticed that all the things that drove you crazy about that person suddenly seem so precious and sweet. So there's a lot of laughter in memorial services. And, you know, even children, I teach third grade and eight-year-olds, they think about death. I think it's because at that age you're sort of noticing you're a separate person from your parents. And if you're separate from them, then something could happen to them, and then where would you be? So they start thinking about death around the time I start teaching them. And I was walking down the hallway one day, and these two little girls, Tessa and Talia, were walking behind me. And Talia said, would you rather be buried or cremated? And Talia said, I don't know, surprise me. You know, so there's a lighthearted approach to death. And, you know, sometimes things are so outrageously bad that all we can do is laugh. You know, and for Day of the Dead, I ask my kids to think about and honor someone or a pet who's died. And so we were doing this one day, and some people talked about their grandparents or their dog who died, and then Chris started talking. And Chris said that one day not too long ago, she'd gone to a soccer game, and she had left her hamster in her bedroom with the door closed, and she had a goldfish bowl in there as well. And when she came back from the soccer game and opened her bedroom door, she was horrified to see that somehow her hamster had climbed up on her bunk bed and had fallen into the fish bowl and drowned, and all the fish flew out and died. And, you know, when she said this, we all just started giggling. And then laughing, and even Chris was laughing. And, you know, I said to them, you know, it's not funny that all your pets died at once, but, you know, sometimes things are so bad, all you can do is laugh. Who could have imagined a scenario like that? So my third graders definitely helped me lighten up. So what part does humor have in our lives? You know, I saw a movie about a family that was dealing with cancer. It was a French movie. And at the end of the movie, I thought there was something really off about that movie. And what was off about it was that nobody laughed. Nobody joked around. And that's so important. And such a kind of dark humor can come about when somebody's dying. I know when my dad was dying, my brother and I, we just felt so honored to be with him during that process and to kind of midwife him through the process of dying. But I don't know how we could have gotten through that without laughter, you know? I remember leaning over my dad, you know, and saying to him very gently, Dad, would you like me to sing to you? And he looked up and said, no, thanks. So my brother and I would share these things with each other, and it, you know, it helped us survive. So humor helps us get through very dark times in our life. And it's not a dishonor to those dark times. It's not an affront to our serious practice or our wholehearted effort to have a little bit of detachment so that we can also have humor. And of course, in humor, we can convey our affection for and connection to one another. Often the way you figure out somebody's meant to be a friend of yours is that you share the same sense of humor. Sometimes you meet someone and you just know that there's an affinity from their sense of humor. This can be one of the little hooks we send out into the world to draw people to us that can be compatriots to us. And humor can really transform an argument as well. You know, if you're having a serious argument with a friend and suddenly one of you can crack a joke, it transforms everything, and then the seriousness of that conflict just evaporates. And then, of course, humor is remembering shared bonds with another person. I remember when my dad was sick, my brother and I took him to the doctor, and the doctor said he needed a blood transfusion, he was dying of lung cancer, and so we set up, you know, that he could get a transfusion the next day. And we're in the car, and my brother was driving, my dad was sitting in the front, and my dad was a notary, and he said, "Wait a minute, I can't get a transfusion tomorrow, I have a notary appointment." And my brother and I just looked at each other in the mirror like, "What?" You know? And my brother, we're sort of communicating non-verbally, my brother goes, "Dad, don't you think a blood transfusion takes priority over an appointment?" My dad said, no, I've worked with these people for years, I'm not going to let them down." And he died in Coming Home Hospice, and he gave up all the other aspects of his business, but he would notarize people's papers there in the hospice. And I'd come in, and he was just so thin and at the very end of his life, but he'd have a $10 bill in his pajama pocket because he notarized somebody's will, even though he couldn't get out of bed. And that, I think that sense of, that he had a sense of purpose in life, that he continued going out into these terrible windstorms to notarize things for people, even though he was really on his last legs. And my dad had a wonderful sense of humor, even when he couldn't speak anymore. I remember I said to him, you know, when he was quite near the end, I said, "Dad, Pete and I are going to have to do your taxes, you know, after you go, and you're self-employed, you know, how do you put together the numbers for your taxes?" My dad could hardly speak, but he goes, you know, as if to say, he pulls them out of thin air, right? His sense of humor was the last to go. Sometimes we have a moment when we notice that we actually have a choice whether to respond with irritation and anger or with humor. And this happens to me a lot with my third graders because they can be quite trying, you know. And sometimes I'll just have this moment where I could say, "Well, I could make a joke about this," or "I could really get annoyed." And this week I decided it might be a good idea to stop being surprised when third graders act like third graders. And I thought maybe I could stop being surprised when people act like people, or when the world acts like the world. You know, I mean, maybe this is part of our suffering or conflict in life, is that we keep expecting or hoping that things are going to be different. So if we can open up to what's actually going on and have a sense of humor about it, this is healthy, I think, you know. Sartre said that hell is other people, but maybe heaven is other people. My friend James always says, people, they're not what they're cracked up to be. So if we can have a sense of humor about one another, cut each other a little slack, you know, this is another way that humor can help us. And certainly humor can point to a larger truth. You know, often when something's funny, it's funny, but not in a superficial way. It's because it connects us to unsuspected things or larger truths. You know, sometimes we cry because something's true, and sometimes we just throw our head back and laugh because something's true. So self-deprecating humor is especially helpful in our practice, and I think that one monk that was so shocked that the other monk picked up that young woman didn't have much of a sense of humor about it. But maybe he was a little self-righteous, and I think humor can keep us from being self-righteous in our practice, you know, or taking ourselves too seriously. I love this story from the Jewish tradition where a rabbi was walking through the temple, and he was overcome with humility threw himself to his knees and he started beating his breast and saying, "I'm nothing, I'm nothing." And then the cantor comes in and he sees the rabbi on his knees and he's also overcome with humility and, "I'm nothing, I'm nothing." And then the janitor comes in and he's so moved to see these great men he so reveres saying they're nothing that he too throws himself down on his knees. "I'm nothing, I'm nothing." And the rabbi looks back and he says to the cantor, "So, look who thinks he's nothing." I was reading a book about, you know, it's a spiritual magazine, and this woman was sitting, she's working very hard on her humility, and, you know, she'd really plumbed the depths of her character and was working on humility, and she was in this meeting, and she looked around, and she found herself thinking, "I've got more humility than anybody in this room." But of course, because of her practice, she thought, "Wait a minute, you know." Then that's when we can really laugh at ourselves. Humor isn't always politically correct. It's not always in good taste. It's not always right speech, but it is a necessary to help us let off steam. And humor gives us the freedom to be outrageous or even offensive. The editor of The Onion can get away with things that other journalists can't. And I'll never forget that the day after Obama was elected, the headline in The Onion was, "Black man gets worst job in America." And boy, I wish I'd saved that. I'm sure that's a collector's item today. You know, and there is this tradition of the court jester. And in Shakespeare, one of my favorite plays is King Lear. And in King Lear, the jester can say things to the king that would end in the death of somebody else. And that's his role, is to entertain the king, but also to point out his foibles and faults. And as King Lear makes one egregious error after another, the jester's there the whole time, telling him, "Be careful. You know, be careful of those daughters of yours." And of course, the king doesn't listen. But, you know, I think gay culture in America has been very important in terms of pointing the finger at ridiculous things in culture, humor to the point of exaggeration and camp, you know, and the whole idea of a court jester, of finding our weak spots and pointing at them. And this is something I really appreciate about gay culture and that I really appreciated about Isan as well. And through exaggeration, we can get at a fundamental truth. So some of our court jesters are Tina Fey and Jon Stewart and Bill Maher and Stephen Colbert. And their humor had a huge effect on the election when Obama was elected. So I think about the subversive power of humor with our precious freedom of speech, you know, political cartoons, except about Muhammad, of course. Mm-hmm. Speaking truth to power. You know, Tina Fey did such a spot-on job of parodying Sarah Palin that people think Sarah Palin said that she would be good at world affairs because she could see Russia from her house. She didn't say that. Sarah Palin said that. Humor isn't necessarily benign, though, and I want to talk a little bit about right speech. In fact, it can be quite aggressive, and you've probably heard comedians use the expression, you know, "I really killed," or "he crushed," you know, or "she bombed," or "he died up there." You know, this whole thing of a comedian just getting on stage and riffing, and the kind of aggressive nature of humor. I grew up in a household where there was a lot of teasing, and I learned to get as good as I got. But sometimes and that was a fun part of my family. Humor was really important. And my dad valued nothing more than a quick comeback, you know. And my dad would tell stories on himself that I can just remember with such affection. He couldn't wait to get home and tell us about some ridiculous thing he'd done or some humiliating event that had happened that he just thought was hysterically funny. But sometimes I don't look forward to seeing certain people because their default is to mock others and then say, "I was just kidding." And I've certainly done this myself. You know, I love the expression, I would have bit my tongue if my foot hadn't been in my mouth. Because sometimes, just in an effort to be funny, I'll say things and I'll think, oh my God, did I really say that out loud? But I notice I don't tease people that I don't already like and feel comfortable with. You know, to me it is usually a form of affection. But still, it's worth asking in our speech with others whether teasing is genuinely affectionate or disguised hostility. Interestingly, the word sarcasm literally means to rip the flesh. And as a teacher, I have to be very careful with my sense of humor because it can be so devastating to a child to be embarrassed or to be the victim of sarcasm. So, sometimes you realize that people's sense of humor came about as a form of protection in childhood, or a form of defense, or a way of entertaining a depressed parent. A lot of comics say this, that they became funny because entertain or make a depressed mother or father laugh, or a child who saw their parents laughing at Bill Cosby or some other comedian and thought, that's what I want to do. I want to make people laugh. Chris Rock talks about that. You know, I know Terry Gross asked him if he drank. He said, I'm way too small to drink. You know, I can't drink. I've got to be funny instead. That's how I protect myself. And growing up, he grew up in a very tough neighborhood. They were very poor. He said, we weren't worried about red meat. We were worried about green meat. We didn't worry about eating red meat. But he talks about, you know, how the only way he could protect himself on the street was by disarming people with his humor. And I watch his specialties. I've seen a few of them. And he has this interesting pattern where he wins his audience over with very crude, transgressive humor, and then he slowly starts introducing political themes or civil rights themes into his humor. In one of his specials, right after Obama got elected, he said, George Bush was so bad that he made it impossible for a white man to get elected this year. So, you know, I hope that our practice can come with laughter. Suzuki Roshi said a lot of funny things, like, life is like getting on a boat that's about to sail out to sea and sink. I like that one. Or he quoted Dogen, that life is one continuous mistake. So I think that those are for sure. But I invite you to think about right speech in regards to humor, because it can be this bonding, wonderful elixir between us, but it can also be quite destructive. So I invite you to think about right speech in regards to humor. And especially when we're speaking about another person who's not there, you know, speaking to a third person about somebody who's not there, and thinking, is this something I'd be comfortable having that person hear, you know, or would I want my teacher to hear me saying this, or would I want my mother, you know, to hear me speaking like this, you know, and when speaking to another, am I using humor to mock and belittle, or am I using humor to connect and convey affection? So, you know, I can see in myself how I'm sometimes a wise ass just to protect myself. And I can use humor to keep people at a distance. And I did this quite a bit when I first started practicing, until I sort of started reflecting on it and seeing how humor was a defense in me and a kind of brittle way of keeping a margin around myself. So, you know, how can I use humor in a wholesome way? And can I find humor and at the same time avoid doing harm to self or others? At its best and most wholesome, humor helps us to lighten up and not take ourselves so seriously. So of course we should take our practice seriously and be grateful to all those who came before us in our lineage. And we should practice diligently with wholehearted effort. But I do hope in our practice we can also lighten up a bit and create a sense of warm-hearted detachment in our practice, a kind of lightness, you know. humor and lightness are a form of detachment, but not a cold detachment that refuses to engage in the world, not a cynical detachment, but this sort of sense of warm-hearted detachment that comes from recognizing the truth of impermanence and that the difficulties we're experiencing will arise and pass away, that the dark time we may be going through is just another part of the path and will pass away like everything else. You know, and I think this truth of impermanence, I often think of impermanence as, oh yeah, everybody dies and friends betray you and teeth decay, and you know, but there's this other side of impermanence that without impermanence, we could never have come to practice and changed our lives. Without impermanence, our children wouldn't grow up. And without impermanence, we wouldn't be able to go through a difficult time and process it and come to terms with it and maybe later even be able to laugh at it. So this young guy goes to the Super Bowl and he's got a really bad seat. And he looks way down below and he sees this old man sitting by himself. There's an empty seat next to him. So the young man goes down and he says, yeah, I couldn't help but notice that this seat is empty. I'm wondering, is it available? And the old man says, sure, sure, please join me. And then he says to the young man, you know, I was married to the most wonderful woman for 50 years and we attended 30 Super Bowls together. She's passed away now, but you're sitting in the seat she would have been in today. So thank you for coming and joining me. And the young man says, well, I hope this isn't too personal. I don't want to pry, but didn't you have a family member or a friend who could have come and been with you today? And the old man said, well, they're all at the funeral. So I hope we can take a page from Tendo Nyojo. I've given you my all, tossing it your way with a hearty laugh. I entrust it all to the spring wind, for there is nothing more that I need to do. So thank you very much, and I'd love to hear from you, especially if humor, how humor is a part of your practice, and if humor helped you go through a difficult time in your life with equanimity and a sense of warm detachment, you know, or anything else you'd like to talk about. Yeah.
First off, thank you for that great lecture. I'm going to laugh so much on lecture. I don't know when. And this was the perfect format for it as well.
Sitting in the living room.
Yeah. Sitting around laughing. when you were talking about, you know, like a sense of lightness and humor being kind of connected, it made me think that, you know, every once in a while, there'll be a feeling of sort of buoyancy in my life for you know, that's connected with my practice. And I think that sense of buoyancy is also somehow connected with the ability to sort of take things lightly.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, well.
Yeah. And it's a kind of grace, isn't it? Because we can't make that happen.
Yeah.
But David, I think to notice it when it arises is really important, and to savor that those light moments, you know. Thank you for that. I like that word buoyancy.
Turn buoyancy, and as you were saying it, I was visualizing myself surfing through one, with humor. And, kind of
sometimes
nice.
The wave comes crashing over you.
And then there's those sharks down below, fly. But that's a beautiful image. Yeah.
somewhat about, I mean, I guess it can contain the humor piece, but it just in general, I've been curious about this a lot. So I find myself, and I hear in other people as you get older, you know, you kind of look at younger generations and sort of critique what they aren't that your great generation was. And and certainly, I think probably all throughout human time, there's always been the, and now the world is coming, truly coming to an end. You know, wasn't, I think we've always been saying that probably since the beginning, and we're still sort of sticking with that. But I wonder, since you work with children, I think you've done that for quite a while, a significant number of years, do you actually see sort of generational changes? And I mean, even I think sometimes with the internet and that access that younger kids might have to just sort of this, and you know, adult or even not adult world, but just so much information. Is there, I mean, do you genuinely see over the decades kind of changes and shifts in the way that they are? Are they just kind of the same kids with just sort of different sets of things?
Yeah. I feel kind of tearful when you ask that question. And I've been teaching kids for 30 years.
Yeah.
And I have to smile when you know, of course, you know, when I wore mini skirts and listened to the Beatles, my parents would this younger generation. And when I see kids going around with their earbuds on, or sometimes I have my earbuds on, you know, or talking, texting each other, there's a movie out right now kind of about this, teenagers who are sexting and texting each other but scared to death to meet one another face to face, and you know, they hook up in this sort of impersonal way. So one thing I see in younger kids is much less ability to pay attention. Their attention span has shrunk. Not so many of my kids, I don't think, are addicted to computers, although some of them do, their parents do let them play video games, you know, endlessly. Interestingly, Steve Jobs limited the screen time of his own kids, both computers and TV. And there's so much research out now about what this is doing to our brains, this constant interconnectivity. On the other hand, I just hope there's something universal in children and in people, and that we go through waves. You know, one thing that that comes to mind is thinking about fast food really took hold, right? And now there's this slow food movement and this organic food movement. So I feel quite pessimistic sometimes. One of my third graders asked me, "Laura, is there going to be any nature there when I grow up?" You know? And I have to encourage kids and say that there are adults that are protecting the environment, and you know, you might want to do that when you grow up. While at the same time, I'm feeling quite pessimistic about it myself. And at the same time, there's hope there that as we go in one direction towards addiction to technology, that there may be a corrective movement going in the other direction.
Yeah.
And you know, I live right next door to Zen Center, and when I go to the Zendo in the morning, or you know, saying to Mio, when I walk in this Zendo here, I'm so moved. I mean, there's such a feeling of timelessness in these rooms. There have been subtle changes. There's much nicer lighting down there now, but basically that room is the same. The temple at Zen Center is the same as when I came there in 1975. And I remember I was at Green Gulch once, and somebody brought a one of those little handheld devices in to schedule Dokusan, and the abbot said, "No, we're not going to be doing that," you know. So I do see changes in children. I don't think they spend enough time with their parents. They don't have, I mean, I work at a private school where the kids are very privileged, and they don't necessarily have table manners, much less sit down and eat with their family every night. So you opened up a can of worms here, because I could talk all day about this.
Yeah.
But it's a wonderful question, and I have faith that the corrective of the human spirit. And, you know, there's such a huge upswell now of interest in mindfulness. You know, I got training at mindful schools in Oakland, and I do mindfulness with my kids. And they love it. I mean, they're very silly about it at first, you know. But they get so they really like to sit silently. It's just for a minute or two. But I'll say, now, what did you hear? What did you feel? What does your heart feel like today? And so I know we live in the Bay Area where this kind of thing is very prevalent, but this is really taking root across the country of people, and in, I know in corporations too, and Norman Fisher and Mark Lesser lecture at Google, you know. So I do have hope.
Yeah, I'm kind of finding myself in a similar situation. And I watch a lot of documentaries, so I think, well, humans have been destroying the environment for a long time. I mean, there's a lot of desertification that's happened in, you know, other parts of the world from, you know, over-foresting and, you know, doing horrible things. So I kind of look at that. And then I work in sort of I work in human resources, so I read all these studies about, you know, people who are in their 20s coming into the workforce and just how awful they were and, you know, how different they were. But now I work with several of them, and there's actually a really kind of nice, connected, positive energy, and they also they seem, because of the internet, more informed about a lot of things than what I remember experiencing before. So I've been finding myself trying to sort of say exactly what you're saying, is that, you know, human beings somehow find a way to kind of correct things generally, and trying to think that way a little bit more anyway.
That's right. And I think we underestimate that we can have an effect in a quiet way in the world. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh says, if we are peaceful, if we are happy, then everyone in our whole family and our whole society will benefit from our happiness. So I don't think we, you know, I remember Harry Roberts was a Yurok Indian that lived at Green Gulch for many years. You probably remember him, Mio, and you know, the students there would say to him that they felt such guilt and such despair about you know, what white people had done to the Native Americans and to the Native environment. And he said, they said, what can we do? You know, and he said, what you can do is live your own life with integrity. And you don't know what ripples go out from you or how you've affected other people. You know, sometimes somebody will say to me, I'll never forget when you said, and I go, oh God, what did I say? I kind of brace myself, you know. Maybe I said some great thing that helped them that I don't even remember. So Mother Teresa said, we can do no great things, but we can do small things with great love. Of course, we can't all be Mother Teresa or Angelina Jolie, but you know, we can do a little bit. Yes?
What about... is there a special place for humor in recovery work?
Absolutely. We laugh a lot in recovery. But, you know, Mio, I often think probably if other people who don't share our checkered past who come into these rooms are kind of amazed that we're laughing about head-on collisions and, you know, or the horrible things that happen. In recovery, the reason we can laugh, I think, we laugh from identification with one another, those of us in recovery, because we've been there together. You know, I love this saying that hell is for people, religion is for people who don't want to go to hell, and spirituality is for people who've been there and don't want to go back. And in the rooms of recovery, we have been to hell and don't want to go back. And so there's a sense of identification and a shared purpose. But also, we laugh because we don't do those things anymore. And because of delight in the mystery that, you know, for those of us who struggle with substance abuse, we went down this path, and then one day, for no reason we can truly understand, we turned in another direction. And it's very mysterious, you know. So when I hear other people's recovery stories, if we were just talking about our personal adventures in addiction, it wouldn't be very interesting. In fact, it would be really boring. But when someone's telling their story and they come to that place in the road where they changed, it's I just get goosebumps, you know. And in that moment, my own sobriety is renewed, and it's a wonderful moment. And I think of Robert Thurman, who said that meditation isn't just sitting on the cushion. It's recognizing our radical dharmic freedom, then, that when we're confronted with a choice, rather than reacting instinctively, we turn in the appropriate direction. And so to me, this is what recovery is, and this is what practice is. It's just as we sit and return to our breath over and over again, we turn in the appropriate direction over and over again. And often that's, you know, totally have to retrain our brain to do that, because our habit mind is carrying us off in a self-destructive direction or a negative direction or a depressive direction or a tragic direction that we have a right to. That's part of our story. But we have to retrain ourselves sometimes to savor positive experiences and look for hope. And, you know, if I'm in despair about children, I have to find the bright spots and the jewels that are there as well. So thank you for asking that, because I think in recovery we laugh a lot. And some people must scratch their heads about the things we laugh about. But and there again, that's a kind of bonding. So have you been through a time in your life where humor was helpful? You found something to that helped you lighten up?
To help me lighten up, I think all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're talking about self-deprecating humor, I was thinking about that the other day because, you know, all of us are self-deprecating. We're here in this room on a Saturday afternoon. you know, it's sunny outside, and just the idea that I find myself thinking, oh, I'm self-deprecating again, you know, that in itself goes into question, like, why do I feel that way? You know, what am I missing?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a nice way to just use the word detach, you know. I don't know, maybe we do detach in a way just so that we can relook at the situation and observe it.
Yeah.
So. You know, sometimes I wonder with the self-deprecating, you know, being brought up Catholic, and, you know, I think sometimes I have, like floggers in my pocket, and I'm really flogging in front of my partner, in front of my family, and
yeah.
and friends, and for what, you know?
Yeah.
And then sometimes I wonder whether or not do I actually miss something really important there,
mm-hmm.
you know? So I'll laugh at myself, or observe myself, maybe not literally laugh, but yeah, it is kind of funny, you know, or
yeah.
but it's a nice way to also take it seriously, that maybe there's something missing there,
uh-huh.
you know, that needs to be, you know, learned, or, you know, do I need to ask for help for something, or,
mm-hmm.
yeah, so it's a nice way to step back, just to observe, not necessarily detach.
Yeah. To step away and then maybe come back with a fresh point of view.
Point of view, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you. Tom?
Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about this. I was going through a box of things that belonged to my first partner, Brian, who died in that first AIDS wave. He died in 86. And is that the time where you would sort of get diagnosed in September and be dead in November?
Yeah.
And that's kind of what happened to him this time of year, makes me think of him. And his sister, he was, his name was Brian, and he was an alcoholic Irishman. His sisters were Brandy, Brenda, and he had brother's name, Brandon. And he had a sister named Brindis, too. His dad's name.
Did his dad like Brandy, by
his name? Dad's name was Max. I don't know what it is. But when he was really, really sick, and we fought like just cats and dogs, or dogs mostly. We fought. Because we both drank a lot. But when he was really, really sick, one thing he would not give up was shaving himself. So. We gave him a handheld mirror so he could shave himself.
Mm-hmm.
But what he did was, his sister and I took care of it. He would track us with this mirror to see if we were performing our tasks appropriately. And Brenda and I used to say that we didn't want to be Will the mirror. You can have the mirror. But in the box, I found the mirror the other day.
But I remember one day, he like came to the middle of the afternoon and said, "It's cocktail time." And I was like, "Okay, whatever." You know, it's like 2, I think. Now, that was fine by me at the time, too. So I said, "Will you shave and I'll fix my ties?" And so, over in the kitchen, we were in D.C., and we encouraged him to use the mirror to look out at Rock Creek Park where the leaves were changing, but he would track us with the mirror. So I thought he was shaving, and I looked over, and he had the mirror looking at me, and I said, "What are you doing?" And he's like, "I'm watching you struggle to make a correct Mai Tai." And I said, "Well, I hope you enjoy that." And then he put the mirror down and looked at me and said, "Do me a favor, when I'm dead, stop doubting yourself." And I remembered that when I picked up that mirror the other day. So it's funny as hell, but you know.
Yeah.
But that damn mirror. Thanks.
Thank you for sharing that, Tom. It was such a hard time. We lost so many good people.
And the other funny thing about him, when we had his memorial service, it was in Cathedral in D.C. downtown, and he left his ashes in the vestibule while people were milling around, and the priest said, "That's a pretty nice box. You don't want to leave it too near the door." Brought it in.
Tough neighborhood, huh?
Yeah.
I think it's always the humor's always a nice little interruption. I for the reason I don't know, I approach life as kind of an angry, hard to do task most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's nice when that comes in and cuts off that sort of stream, I guess, of my behavior and thinking. So
yeah.
It's a nice interruption.
I just had this funny memory of being at Tassajara during practice period, and it was Rahatsu Sashin. And so there was this tradition that we'd sit and sit and sit at night after the abbot left. And then when he would come back, then the older students could start, the senior students could start leaving. And we were seated in terms of seniority. So the abbot would come back, and then after some time, the senior students would start leaving, and the junior students would have to be the last to leave the zendo. So we'd been sitting such a long time, and we're just in such pain. And then, thank God, we heard Richard Baker come back, and we could hear him walking and getting up on that. This is in the old, was in the old zendo that burned down. Getting up on the was the stage, and Richard sat down, and I was sitting with it next to Ray Crivella. We were both sort of, you might say, junior students, and it's just sitting for hours. And Baker Roshi said, "When Buddha sat down under the Bo tree, he said, 'I will not move from this place until I attain enlightenment.'" And Ray said, "Uh-oh." And the whole zendo just broke up. And it was such a needed moment of humor in that, you know, that stern sitting that we did. I'll never forget that. Where is Ray Crivella today? We don't know. I love the tradition in Zen of these mid-practice period celebrations. This is from, I think it comes from Japan, doesn't it, Myo? Of kind of having that time in the middle of a practice period where there's a night where people make fun of the Roshi and
mm-hmm.
maybe even drink some sake and
yeah.
put on women's clothes or whatever they do, I don't know.
The training we did was only a month, but they made sure to work that in.
Oh, what was it like?
It was just one evening,
uh-huh.
And there was alcohol
uh-huh.
and karaoke singing.
Uh-huh.
The abbot wasn't there, and a lot of it was in Japanese, which I couldn't follow.
Uh-huh.
But people were obviously having a very good time.
Uh-huh.
So,
yeah, what's the thing in the Jewish tradition of around Halloween. It's, does anybody know? It's, it starts with a P.
Passover?
No, not Passover, not Passover. It's a time when everybody gets in, it's not related to Halloween, but people get in costume and act really silly, and it's a wonderful, my sister converted to Judaism, and she loves that night of humor in her temple. Well, maybe that's a good place to stop.
Okay.
Yeah. So thank you all for your kind attention, and Mio, again, thank you for inviting me. I love to return to Hartford Street. Thank you very much.
May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.
Thank you very much.
I'd love to.
Okay. Thank you. Is it Purim?
Purim.
Oh,
Purim.
Purim.
Yeah.